Let's begin hour three of our Learn the Bible in 24 Hours. And we're going to deal with Genesis chapter 4 through 11, which is sometimes called the pre-historical period. Generally, the biblical history in its another sense really starts with Abraham on, but Genesis chapter 4 on. And so we'll be covering a period of time between the fall of man and the call of Abraham, one of the major events, of course, being the flood. And there's much about the flood that most people have not had exposure to. So chapter 4 will be about Cain and Abel, the famous story of the two brothers. Chapter 5 is one of those chapters you usually skip reading the Bible. It's a genealogy of Adam to Noah, but it will include some surprises for many of you. Chapter 6 through 9 is the flood of Noah, and we're going to dwell particularly on the conditions before the flood, which may shock you in terms of the real reason for the flood of Noah. And then at the Tower of Babel and the Table of Nations and all of that will be following. That's hour number 3 of 24. Cain and Abel, the first two children of Adam and Eve, they were giving offerings. Cain gave an offering of his harvest, and Abel offered a lamb. What confuses most people is that Abel happened to be a shepherd and Cain happened to be a tiller of the ground. Don't let that mask the real significance of what's going on. Cain was giving the fruits of his own labors. Abel was offering a lamb. And Cain's offering was rejected. And one of the questions is why? Well, because there was some sin in his life. What it was is unspecified. But one of the things we'll discover subsequently is the offering of a lamb was specified by God earlier in Eden. It's even hinted at with the coats of skins that we talked about. As you go through the rest of the Bible looking back at this, it'll become even clearer. Now, by the way, another thought to consider, how did Cain know that his offering was rejected? And if you study the scripture, you'll discover that when they offered an offering to God, a flame from heaven came down and consumed it. So when your offering wasn't accepted, it was pretty obvious. And Cain was upset, jealous of Abel, murdered Abel. And we all know the story. Now, Genesis chapter 5 has a hidden message that I think it will deserve our closer attention. But first let me start with a riddle. Who is the oldest man in the Bible? Anyone? Methuselah. Thank you. Good. Methuselah is the oldest man in the Bible. He lived 969 years. Yet he died before his father. There's a great riddle to give your friends at the neighborhood Bible study. If Methuselah is the oldest man in the Bible, how could he die before his father? And of course, what everybody forgets is who his father was. His father was Enoch. And Enoch didn't die. He was translated, or raptured, if I may. But it's interesting, this guy Enoch is an interesting guy. Because at the age of 65, something happened in his life, because from that day on, for the next 300 years, he walked with God, whatever that means. Something very dramatic happened. Among other things, his son was born, Methuselah. We also understand that he received a prophecy of his son. Now, you need to understand something about the flood of Noah. The flood of Noah did not come as a surprise. It had been preached on for four generations. But when Enoch came along, God told him that when his son was born, that as long as his son was alive, the judgment of the flood would be withheld. And so we're going to discover some interesting things about this as we go on. Now, genealogy of Genesis 5. In Genesis 5, we have 10 people. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Yared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. The problem here is these names are not translated. Even if you go into a lexicon, they generally don't translate proper names. In Hebrew, the whole Hebrew language is constructed of three-letter roots. Three letters make up a root to verbs and nouns and the rest. And if you know the roots, you can infer what the word means. We'll talk more about that later. But each one of these names in Hebrew has a meaning. Adam. You see, it's transliterated. It's approximate. The pronunciation is approximated in the English. Adam comes Adamah, which means man. That's no problem. Adam means man. We're comfortable with that one. His son, one of his sons, was named Seth. Seth comes from a root which means appointed. And we get a hint of this by Eve in chapter 4, verse 25. When Seth was born, Eve said, "For God hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew." In other words, Abel was killed, so when Seth was born, she felt God was appointing him to take his place. So she named him Seth. He had a son by the name of Enosh. Now that comes from a root which means mortal, frail, or miserable. The root Enosh means incurable. It's usually used of a wound or grief or woe, sickness, or wickedness. It's incurable or mortal in that way. Kenan, not Canaan. Some Bibles has this mistranslated. Kenan, which can mean sorrow, dirge, or elegy. In fact, Balaam in Numbers 24 does a pun on the Kenites, the descendants of Kenan. Well, mortal and sorrow are pretty miserable handles to go through school with. Can you imagine choosing basketball teams? Hey, miserable, sorrow, you're on my side. So Kenan had enough of that. So he named his son when he was born Mahalalel. Now that's a mouthful, but it comes from two Hebrew roots. Mahalal, which means the blessed or praised one, and El, the name of God. So Mahalalel means the blessed God. Mahalalel, Mahalalel. He has a son by the name of Yared, and comes from the verb Yarad, which means shall come down. That's when it's very straightforward, it happens. Enoch, we've talked about, but his name happens to be an academic term. It means commencement or teaching. His son named Methuselah. He was told that when his son was born, the judgment of the flood would be withheld. So he names his son after two Hebrew roots, Muth. That's a root that occurs 125 times in the Old Testament, which means death, and Shalak, which means to bring or send forth. The name Methuselah means his death shall bring or bring forth. It's interesting to realize that if you go through Genesis 5, it tells the ages that people were born and died and so forth. Methuselah was 187 when Lamech, his son, was born, and Lamech was 182 when Noah was born, and it was the 600th year of Noah that the flood came. In other words, the year that Methuselah died is the year the flood came. So his name was fulfilled as a prophecy of the flood of Noah. Girls, can you imagine raising that kid? Every time he came home with a cold, the entire neighborhood would go into panic, right? Methuselah. It's interesting that Methuselah's life becomes a type or a model or an analogy of God's mercy. You see, and because it is, it's the longest lifetime in the Bible. But it is finite. There is a point where God's mercy even reaches its limit. Well, his son was Lamech, and here's a root in which even in our English we retain today in our English word lament or lamentation. It really means despairing. And Noah, we all have heard, how many of you have heard of Noah before? Noah comes from Nacham, which means to bring relief or comfort. The word Noah means comfort or rest. Okay, we've had this little Hebrew lesson. By the way, Lamech even tells us why he mentioned named him Noah. In Genesis 5:29, Lamech says he called his name Noah, saying, "The same shall comfort us concerning our work, our toil of our hands, because of the ground which the Lord hath cursed." Well, let's take a look at the genealogy of Genesis 5. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Yared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. Pretty straightforward, except we don't understand it because we don't know Hebrew. Let's put what we've learned in Hebrew against this. Man is appointed, mortal, sorrow. But the blessed God shall come down teaching that his death, whose death? God's death, shall bring the despairing comfort or rest. Here is a summary of the Christian gospel in the genealogy of Noah. Man is appointed mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down teaching that his death shall bring the despairing comfort or rest. Now this is interesting for several points of view. First of all, there's no way you'll ever convince me that a group of Jewish rabbis contrived to hide a summary of the Christian gospel in a genealogy in their highly venerated Torah. No way. But the other reason this is important, it teaches us something else. It teaches us that God's plan of redemption was not a knee-jerk reaction to Adam's screw-up. It was planned from the beginning. You're going to discover that the entire Bible is designed skillfully Every number, every letter, every word is there by design, and the design always causes it to point to Jesus Christ. Well, let's move on. One integrated design. The New Testament is in the Old Testament concealed. The Old Testament is in the New Testament revealed. There's much in the Old Testament you have no chance of understanding until you understand the New Testament. And then it all becomes clear, and you also see the fingerprints of the Holy Spirit over all of it. So you and I have two basic discoveries. I want to remind you. The Bible consists of 66 separate books penned by 40 different guys, didn't even know each other, over several thousand years, and yet it's an integrated message. Even the numerics and the hidden structures of the text demonstrate its pre-design. And yet it can be demonstrated that the origin of that message is from the outside of time because it writes history before it happens. It anticipates history in detail. Now let's get on to Noah a little bit. Jesus later talks to his disciples about a second coming, and he makes the strangest remark. He says, "But as the days of Noah were, so shall the days of the coming of the Son of Man be." Matthew 24, verse 37. Most people get into this part of Genesis, spend all the time on how big is the ark and how many animals and all that stuff. Let's set that aside. The bigger question is, why did God resort to something as extreme as destroying all life on the planet Earth except for eight people? I should say nine people. Enoch was removed first. Then the eight were saved by this boat or barge, whatever. Pretty extreme message. Why would that be? And so what does Jesus mean when he says the second coming will be similar as the days of Noah? See, our problem isn't that Noah's flood. Our problem is we haven't done our homework as to the days of Noah, what they were all about. And it all starts in Genesis chapter 6, first couple of verses. Verse 1 and 2, "It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose." Now the first observation you should make is you notice that the first two verses are one sentence. If people would just notice that, they could avoid so many errors. We're talking about men in general and daughters in general. When men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the B'nai HaElohim, the word sons of God in the Hebrew, is what we want to take a look at. B'nai HaElohim. It's a Hebrew term that is used exclusively in the Old Testament of angels. And in the Old Testament, you find it in Job 1, verse 6, 2, verse 1, 38, 7. In the New Testament, you find the equivalent thought in Luke 20, verse 36. There was a popular book. It's not part of the Bible, don't misunderstand me, but a very, very widely circulated, highly venerated book from about 200 B.C. to about 200 A.D. was the Book of Enoch, which, if nothing else, is expressive of the vocabulary and grammar of the period and reflects the understanding of the people at time, and it clearly deals with these fallen angels. The Septuagint, which is a translation of the Old Testament done in the 3rd century before Christ, we're going to be talking a lot about this interesting translation before we're through. The Septuagint, clearly, because the Greek, it's a translation of the ancient Hebrew into the Greek, done by the world experts 3 centuries before Christ was born. It uses the precision of the Greek to clearly identify these as angels, obviously fallen angels. And they came to the daughters of men, Benath Adam, daughters of Adam, not daughters of Cain. I'll explain why I'm making that distinction. These are the same as the earlier part of the sentence in Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. A couple of verses later, we find out what happens when these fallen angels commingle with the daughters of men. It says, "There were Nephilim in the earth in those days." The word Hebrew, the word Nephilim, I'll come to in a minute. "And also after that," important phrase, "when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, they bare children unto them. The same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown." What on earth is going on here? The word Nephilim comes from the Hebrew word Nephal, which means to fall, be cast down, to fall away, desert. The Nephilim were fallen ones. They were hybrids of these angels and humans, apparently. In the Greek, which is even more precise, in the Septuagint Greek, they're called gigantes. Now, it's transliterated giants, and they did happen to be giants, but don't let that confuse you. The word gigas, it comes from meaning earthborn. These were the hybrids, the demigods that were celebrated in the Greek legends and others. It's translated in the English giants. They did happen to be giants, but that's not the key distinctive. Now, we get another clue about all this in the 9th verse of chapter 6. These are the generations, or the family tree, if you will, of Noah. Noah was a just man. Doesn't mean he was sinless. He was justified by faith. But anyway, Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. What does that mean? And he walked with God. Tamim is the word used there. It means without blemish, sound, healthful, without spot, unimpaired. It's always used in the Old Testament of physical defects. So what this verse is actually saying is that Noah was distinctive in that he had an unblemished genealogy. Now we're beginning to get the picture. Apparently there's some kind of weird goings on with these fallen angels and women creating a hybrid race. Noah was among those, maybe not the only one, but he was among those that had an unblemished genealogy. We're talking about a gene pool problem. Now, if this is correct, it should be confirmed by two or three witnesses. Let's take a look at the New Testament. We'll take a pre-glimpse here. In Jude chapter 1, verse 6 and 7, it's only one chapter book, Jude verses 6 and 7, Jude, the brother of Jesus Christ, he makes this interesting mark. He makes an allusion to this event. He says, "And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness under the judgment of that great day. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh," are set forth an example and goes on. In other words, he talks about these angels that somehow left their first estate, they left their own habitation. The word habitation there is okaterion. It's a Greek word, occurs only twice in the Bible. Here, and referring to the believer's resurrection body. This is a body that these angels disrobed from in order to indulge in this mischief. And apparently, like, they were just like Sodom and Gomorrah going after strange flesh. So we find that the nature of their commerce with the women was sexual in nature. Peter also comments about this and adds some detail. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 and 5. "For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to Tartarus," I'll come back to that word, "and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved on judgment, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah." Peter says pretty much the same thing Jude does, except he adds an interesting detail. It's the days of Noah. He makes that remark. The word Tartarus that Peter uses doesn't occur anywhere else in the New Testament, but it is a well-established word in the Greek language. It's the Greek term for the dark abode of woe. It's the pit of darkness in the unseen world. In Homer's Iliad, it's described as being as far below Hades as the earth is below heaven. So I don't know what it is, but I don't think I want to go there. Okay? It's interesting that there are legends in every ancient culture of star people or some beings coming down and cohabiting with the dwellers in Sumer, in Assyria, Egypt, Incas, Mayan, Gilgamesh, Persia, certainly the Greek legends, which look at a few of those, India, Bolivia, South Sea Islands, even the Sioux Indians and others. I understand from anthropologists that the American Indians, when they met a stranger, they had a habit of holding up a hand so they could count fingers. They were fearful of the six-fingered star people. Now, the Greek Titans is another example, perhaps the best known in our culture. These Titans that are of legend in Greece were partly terrestrial, partly celestial. They rebelled, according to their folklore, against their father Uranus. And after a prolonged contest, they were defeated by Zeus and condemned where? Into Tartarus. The word Titan in the Greek is Shaitan in the Chaldean, which is Satan in the Hebrew. And if you look at the pictures of the demigods and so forth, you've got the famous picture of Atlas and Hercules on the left and Atlas on the right. These were Nephilim in the Hebrew, presumably, in their folklore. Now, many people have studied the Bible, have graduated from many prominent seminaries, have never heard this before because they were taught what the lines of Seth view of this passage. The idea that the sons of God represent the leadership of the believers, and that the daughters of Adam really means the daughters of Canaan. That's not what the text says. That sin, the sin that was involved was their failure to maintain separation between the lines of between Seth and Cain, is the thought. But there's no explanation of how these could have supernatural offspring, believers and unbelievers, if you will. This line of Seth theory actually started in the 5th century. Celsus and Julian the Apostate used the traditional angel view, if you will, to attack Christianity, and it was an embarrassment to many. So Julius Africanus resorted to the Sethite theory as a more comfortable way of explaining the text. And Cyril of Alexandria used it to repudiate the Orthodox position. Augustine embraced the Sethite theory, and thus it became embedded in the theology of the medieval church, and has been carried even by the denominational, most of the Protestant denominations into their theology. It prevailed in the Middle Ages. Now, the text itself violates all that. Sons of God is never used of believers in the Old Testament. Seth was not God, Cain was not Adam, which is what that theory, in effect, has to require. And there's no mention of daughters of Elohim in the whole picture. There's a grammatical antithesis that's also ignored. I won't get into that here. The idea of separation being inferred, that doesn't even become a factor until five chapters later. The lines aren't even defined until Genesis 11. Separation is imposed only upon Isaac, will come, and not on Ishmael and others. In Genesis 6, it says, all flesh was corrupted. There's no godly line being spared. If so, why weren't they on the boat? Huh? The inferred godliness of Seth is also a myth. You see, only Enoch and Noah's eight were spared from the flood. And the idea that Seth was somehow the good guys is naive because you notice in the passage it says they took them wives of all they chose. It didn't imply they did what they wanted. Why did the Sethites then perish in the flood if they're the good guys? And Enosh, Seth's son, by the way, is the one that definitively initiated the defiance of God, we find out from the text in Genesis 4:26. Then men began to profane the name of the Lord. There's a mistranslation in many English translations. Apostasy began with Enosh, the son of Seth. So the line of Seth theory is pretty frail to begin with. But probably the real nail in the coffin of that view is that the Nephilim were unnatural. And how do believers and unbelievers have supernatural offspring? The angel view that I'm presenting is not unique. This is the ancient rabbinical traditional view of the text. This is the 2nd century B.C. Book of Enoch expands this. Not that it's biblical, but at least explains the prevalent view at the time. The Testament of the 12 Patriarchs is another widely circulated document that supports the same view. Josephus, Flavius, also, all these demonstrate this was the prevailing understanding of the text for centuries before Christ. Perhaps most of all, the Septuagint validates this. Now, our early church fathers also, Philo of Alexandria, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, and all the rest of them, pretty much had the angel view. In modern scholarship, Pember, DeHaan, McIntosh, Dillich, Gabelin, Pink, Barnhouse, Henry Morris, Merrill Unger, Arnold Fuchtenbaum, Hal Lindsey, Chuck Smith, other contemporary experts will also endorse what's called the angel view as being the scriptural view of what's going on. The Seth view is unscriptural because the text itself, the inferred separation, which is premature, the inferred godliness of the Sethites, which is disprovable, the inferred Cainite subset of the Adamites, which is disprovable, unnatural offspring, and New Testament confirms. But the real reason I emphasize so strongly in this review is I discovered when we did our book on this whole subject, you also will not understand the rest of the Old Testament unless you understand that this happened again. And the post-flood and some other prophetic issues will not make sense unless you really understand what went on in Genesis chapter 6. There were post-flood Nephilim, Genesis 6:4 said, and also after that. We don't know how or when. We do know that when Abraham was told by God that his descendants would come back in the land 400 years later, that Satan then had 400 years to lay down a minefield. And he apparently did. We'll get to that when we get to that review. There are four tribes that the Rephaim, the Emim, the Harim, and the Zumzumim in Genesis 14 to 15 that God tells them to wipe out every man, woman, and child of those races. When we read that as New Testament readers in the Old Testament, we get shocked. Sounds so inhumane. No, again, we're dealing with a gene pool problem. In the book of Joshua, we'll deal with all of that. There's Arba, Anak, and the seven sons, the Anakim, that are encountered in Canaan. When Moses sends the 12 spies in the land, 10 come back, terrified of what? Nephilim in the land. That's the word they use in Numbers 13:33. Og, the king of Bashan, was the king of the giants of the Nephilim. Goliath and his four brothers were sons of Anak, offspring of these Nephilim. So Satan had a lot of strategies. We're going to look a lot at Satan's strategies behind the scenes. The corruption of Adam's line in Genesis 6 is just one of them. Abraham's seed being attacked, Genesis 12 and 20, the famine in Genesis 50, the destruction of the male line by the Pharaoh of Egypt in Exodus 1. Pharaoh's pursuit of Israel after letting them go is again an attempt to wipe out the race. The populating of Canaan in Genesis 12:6, and also as God defines his plan of redemption to be through the line of David is singled out for attack. Joram kills his brothers. The Arabians slew all but one. Every time they try to wipe out the line, there's always a servant that hides one of the babies that keeps the line of David intact. And Hezekiah, we'll talk more about this as we go. Haman in the book of Esther is part of Satan's attack to try to wipe out God's plan of redemption in Esther chapter 3 and so forth. In the New Testament, we find the same thing. Joseph's fears in Matthew 1. Herod's attempts, killing all the babes in Bethlehem in Matthew 2. And trying to throw Jesus off the cliff in Nazareth in chapter 4. The two storms on the sea of Nazareth, I believe, were supernatural. We had experienced fishermen aboard that knew those waters that were terrified of their lives. No, it wasn't just normal storms, I don't believe. And Jesus rebukes the sea, if you recall. We'll get into that later. And, of course, the ultimate stratagem was the cross. And the summary of all of this will be in Revelation 12. We'll review it then. And God and Satan is not through yet. He's still at it. Now, we need to know something about the nature of angels if we're going to be sophisticated in our understanding of the Scripture. Angels always appear in human form. Always. Sodom and Gomorrah. They're always in pairs, too, by the way. Sodom and Gomorrah. At the resurrection. At Christ's ascension. They spoke with people. They took men by the hand. They ate meals with them. The writer of Hebrews tells us that many of us have entertained angels unawares. Now, we know that angels are capable of direct physical contact. The Passover in Egypt was executed by the angel of death. After dinner one night, an angel slaughters 185,000 Syrians. You don't mess with angels. You know? Now, they don't marry in heaven. We'll come back to that before we're through. Jesus makes the remark, for speaking of our resurrection bodies, for in resurrection they either marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels in heaven. The angels in heaven don't marry. Why? Because they're immortal. Procreation is for a mortal race that has to have progeny. It doesn't say angels don't have sex. It says they don't marry. It doesn't say they have sex either. Don't misunderstand me. It makes no comment on the technology available to angels bent on mischief. It makes no comment on that at all. And the word habitation, I mentioned this before, the okoterion, refers to the body as the dwelling place for the spirit. It occurs only twice in the Bible. In Jude 6, it's that from which the angels had disrobed to conduct this mischief. 2 Corinthians 5:2, it alludes to the heavenly body which you and I long to be clothed with. Okoterion, the resurrection body. Well, let's see. Let's take a look at it. For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have the building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is from heaven, the Orchiterion. Same thing that the angels left their habitation. Well, let's get at the flood itself. How many have heard of Noah's Ark? Approximately 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. It's about 20,000 tons, approximately the size of the Titanic, with one distinctive. Didn't sink. That represents about 1.5 million cubic feet, 522 standard livestock railroad cars, it would seem. Figuring about 240 sheep per car, that would make room for about 125,000 sheep-sized equivalents, if using that as an average, a mean. And there's an estimate of about 18,000 sheep. It's interesting how many people say, well, there wasn't room in the ark. They don't know how big the ark was. They don't know how many species to get in there, but they know it wasn't big enough. You know, if you do some rough arithmetic, you can at least rationalize that it's possible. In fact, we know what happened. Now, the other question I want to really focus on is how many of each animal did Noah take into the ark? And everybody says, well, two of each kind, except those that have been paying a little more attention. Well, two of each of the unclean, the common animals, but seven each of the clean animals. Now, stand by. This is an important insight. Next time someone gets into a discussion here, ask them, how did Noah know what was clean and unclean? Those are Levitical definitions that will be defined later on in the days of Moses in his writings, in Leviticus and so forth. What this tells us is Noah knew what God was talking about, which tells us those concepts were not originated in the days of the Exodus and following. They were ordained in Eden and simply codified in certain forms in the covenant with Moses. Noah knew what was clean and unclean, and I suggest to you also knew what Sabbath was and so forth. That's why the Babylonians also have a seven-day week and so on. It predates Moses and the giving of the law at Sinai. We'll get to that there. Flood itself rained for 40 days, but that doesn't explain it. It wasn't just rain. It also opened the fountains of the deep. There was additional water involved. The waters prevailed for 150 days. They were in the ark 371 days, 5 months floating and 7 months on the mountain. Now, a couple of perspectives here. There was only one ark. There was only one door to that ark. We need to recognize God's provision for his redemption here. It's interesting, there were no births or deaths, so everyone on the ark was preserved. How were they? Don't know. For a full year and plus. Most scholars suspect they might have gone into hibernation. God ordained somehow. Who knows? One interesting thing, alternative theological speculations had to end when the door was shut. Everybody's different theories about redemption were useless as they pounded on the door to get in as the waters raised. God's way was specified. God's way was open. That door was open for 7 days before God himself shut it. One of the great theological questions, who shut the door on the ark? God did. Could Noah have gotten out if he wanted to? I don't think so. Now, it's interesting that if you canvass the ancient literature, you'll discover the story of the flood is incorporated in the legends and traditions of the Egyptian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Hindu, Chinese, Druids, Polynesian, Mexicans, Peruvians, American Indians, and the traditions in Greenland. All have flood traditions, many of them containing many of the same elements. Some of the Chinese characters for flood is made up of 8 mouths to feed, interestingly enough. Well, Noah's Ark has been claimed to have been sighted in the ancient Babylonian records, the Greek histories, and I go through a whole list here of dozens of apparent sightings in the records from 275 BC, 30 BC in Egyptian, Nicholas of Damascus, the first century, even Josephus in 70 AD mentions it, and it goes right on through. The Russian aviators in 1916 claimed to have seen it. Of course, then they had the Tsar. Tsar had interest, but the revolution interfered with that. And then a number of visits to the mountain have been recorded, all which interesting stuff. 1993, CBS did a primetime special with photographs of various kinds. All kinds of people claim to have seen or this, that, and the other thing. When you go through all of that, candidly, it's inconclusive. And there is an expedition that has biblical reason to believe that it's actually not on that mountain. That Mount Ararat is actually further to the east. But we'll see as people look. I do believe it will be found when God's timing is such for a number of reasons. On the 264th day, a raven is sent out and disappears because a raven can live off the land. But the 271st day, dove number one is sent out, comes back, can't find a place to rest. 278th day, dove number two returns with a branch from a tree, which says the waters are receding. And it's at the 285th day that the dove number three doesn't return, which means it's found a place to rest. And on the 314th day, Noah removes the roof and they leave the ark. They leave on the 371st day, after 53 weeks in total. I want you to notice there's 30-day months, 360-day years involved here. That turns out to be significant later on. But one of the questions I'm fond of pointing out is, when did the flood actually end? And Genesis chapter 8, verse 4 says, the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. Now, if you're a normal, well-adjusted Bible reader, you'll come across a verse like that and move on. But if you've been to one of Chuck Missler's Bible studies, you are no longer a normal, well-adjusted human being, because you'll remember that I had this peculiar notion that every detail in the Scripture, every number, every place name, is there by design. And so when you come across a verse like this, you'll say to yourself, why on earth did the Holy Spirit want me to know that the ark rested on the seventh month of the 17th day of the month on the mountains of Ararat? Now, the one thing I do want you to remember is that the Holy Spirit always rewards the diligent. Now, you need to understand, to unravel this, you need to do a little bit of homework, because the Jews have two calendars. The regular civil normal calendar has the beginning of the year. Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, is in the fall, typically our September, October. Everybody that has Jewish friends knows that. But they also have a separate calendar, a religious calendar, and it derives from the Passover in Egypt. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 2, God says to Moses, this month, that is the month of Nisan, shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Well, if you look at the two calendars, the month of Tishri is the first month of the normal civil calendar. The month of Nisan, or Aviv sometimes called, is the seventh month of the civil calendar. But it is also thus hereby redesignated as the first month of the new calendar, or the religious calendar. Okay, well, what does all that mean? Well, let's talk about new beginnings. Jesus was crucified on Passover, the 14th of Nisan. How long was he in the grave? Anyone? 3 days. Okay, good. So if he's in the grave 3 days, his resurrection occurred on the 17th of Nisan, right? But Nisan, on the Genesis calendar, is the seventh month. So God's new beginning on the planet Earth in Genesis chapter 8 was on the anniversary, in anticipation of our new beginning in Jesus Christ. And I think that's mind-blowing. Do you see evidence of design here? What a coincidence. Now, the rabbis will tell you, coincidence is not a kosher word. There are no accidents in God's kingdom. How interesting we see even the Ark of Noah and the flood and the new beginning of life on the planet Earth on the very day that you and I are beneficiaries of a new beginning with the resurrection of Jesus Christ on what we tend to call Easter morning. A new beginning. There's a new order in Genesis 9. There are no vegetarians anymore. They're encouraged to eat animals. Capital punishment is ordained as an evidence of human authority over themselves. Thus, human government is established. Sinful man has been wiped out, but not sin. Not sin. And there's a strange episode where Noah has a prophecy. May God enlarge. He has three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And he talks about how that Canaan may be his servant, and I won't get into that here. We're running out of time here. Now, one of the things we should recognize is that, as we talk about the entropy profile of the universe, entropy being the disorder, when you reduce entropy by adding information, and we went through 6 days of adding information, creation, and then it stabilized. Well, with the fall of Adam, we have the loss of information, disinformation. We have decay. We have limited lifetimes, increasingly limited lifetimes, we'll discover. When we get to the flood, there's a major, major loss. And we know the world certainly only from post-fall, post-curse observations. But actually, most of our observations are post-flood also. It's amazing how many scientific conjectures that they puzzle over can be explained if they just pay attention to the fact there was a universal flood at one time. There are post-flood changes. We know the thermal blanket that apparently embraced the Earth where a universal climate was gone. The end of that climate is one of the things. Atmospheric pressure apparently reduced 50%. Pterodactyls can't fly under normal atmospheric pressures. Extended longevity start to decline. These long lifetimes we read about quickly start to decline to ultimately reaching our 70 that we're familiar with. Let's talk a little bit about fossils. There's more misinformation about fossils, and I won't make a big thing here, but I want you to notice something about fossils. Fossils are dead. Did you know that? Which means they came after Adam. So if people like to play around with the interval, the gap theory, whatever, fine. It's got nothing to do with fossils. Even if it's true, it has nothing to do with fossils or dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were post-Adam. They're talked about in the book of Job. So this is all after Adam. Fossils didn't decay. There was a sudden, quick change. Why don't we have fossils today? We don't. Why? Because when something dies, it rots, decays, and elementally gets absorbed. The existence of fossils imply a sudden, drastic, quick change. And the flood explains most of it. You have the smallest ones at the bottoms because they settle. I won't get into that whole thing. But dating depends on circular reasoning. How old is this fossil? Well, it's 10 million years old. How do you know? Because it was in a layer that's 10 million years old. Oh, okay. How do you know that layer is 10 million years old? Well, because it's got these 10 million year fossils in it. You see a problem there? I mean, you get the picture? And, of course, from all this, we teach our kids that we all came from a rock. You know? One other thing about the flood to think about, there are only three groups of people about the flood. Those that perished in the flood, those that were preserved through the flood, the eight in the boat, and those that were removed prior to the flood, Enoch. And we'll talk more about Enoch in this regard. Genesis 10 gives us the table of nations. There's a genealogy there of the 70 families. There were 70 families that entered Egypt in Genesis 46, we'll discover. The bounds were set in Deuteronomy 32. How interesting is there are 70 nations from Noah. That's a very interesting number, 70. We're going to the 70 families that enter Egypt we're going to talk about when we get to Exodus. But 70 nations from Noah had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And every one of us in this room are descendants from one of those three guys, Ham, Shem, or Japheth, or some combination maybe. Ham. From Ham we find as Mitzrayim, which is the Old Testament name for Upper and Lower Egypt. The Philistines actually came from Ham. They're not sons of Ishmael, they're sons of Ham. Cush, which is a term what we sometimes translate Ethiopia, but also includes the Kassites east of Assyria. They settled south of the second cataract of the Nile. From him came Nimrod, the first world dictator, who corrected Babel, Erech, and a number of the early cities. And Put, who settled west of Egypt. Cush is generally viewed ethnologically of the black Africans, where Put is west of Egypt, or the North Africans, the Berbers, and so forth. And Canaan was a son of Ham, from Sidon to Gaza, from Sodom and Gomorrah, and so forth. They're all Canaanite cities. And Kittai, which is Cathay, by the way, the Chinese, and the Sinites also came from Canaan, Sino or China. The Chinese are in the Bible, interestingly enough. The other son is Shem, from which we have Elam, the Persians, Asher, and Arphaxad. And from Arphaxad comes Selah, Eber, from which we get Hebrew, by the way, some people feel, and Peleg, which means in his days the earth was divided. Some people believe it might have been the continental drift issues going on. And, of course, from Peleg we have Reu, Shur, and Mahor, Terah, and Abraham. We're going to talk a lot about Abraham, but he comes from Arphaxad, from Shem. Then we have Japheth, and he's going to be the largest of the group, according to the prophecies. Gomer came from Japheth. Herodotus, Plutarch, and so forth talk a lot about him. The Sumerians settled along the Danube and the Nile. Ashkenaz, which typically focuses on Germany and others. Riphath, which strangely enough is a term from which the word Europe comes from. It's not obvious from the linguistics here. Tagarma is not only the Armenians who call themselves the House of Tagarma, but also Turkey and Turkestan. Magog, we're going to talk a lot about. Magog, we know, is the forebear of the Scythians. That's crucial to our understanding of Ezekiel 38 and 39 to understand who the Scythians were. Hesiod, a contemporary of Ezekiel in the 8th century B.C., a Greek didactic poet, speaks of the descendants of Magog as the Scythians, using the Greek name. Herodotus tells a great deal about their history. Herodotus is considered the father of all history. Wrote about the 5th century B.C. and tells us a lot about the Scythians. We'll talk more about them when we get to Ezekiel 38 and 39. Madai, from them comes the Medes and the Kurds. And everybody wonders, where are the Medes? Well, we call them Kurds today. They emerged about the 10th century B.C., a coalition with Persia in the 7th century B.C. Yavin is Ionia, or Greece. Tarshish, a derivative of them, probably referring to the British Isles, but that's conjectural, and others. In Genesis 11, we have a particular episode, the Tower of Babel, and Bab being Tower, El, the Tower to God, Genesis 11. We know from the scripture the world spoke at that time one language, the language Hebrew, ancient Hebrew. But Nimrod, whose name means we will rebel, was the first world dictator. He organized a godless confederacy. And he organized on the plain of Shinar, which is the general region, in which he built a tower to heaven. Don't think that he's naive enough to climb a ladder to get to heaven. That's not the point. It was an astrological temple of worship where the zodiac was corrupted up until then. We have reason to believe that the Matzaroth, which is the Hebrew term for the zodiac, named 12 groups of stars after the 12 tribes, but in such a way as to lay out in advance God's plan of redemption. From the virgin birth of the constellation we call Virgo to the triumph of the lion of the tribe of Judah that we call Leo. But it's at this place that this was all corrupted in a different way, which results in the labels that to this day in all cultures label those 12 constellations around the zodiac. But you'll discover as you study the Bible, it's really, in a sense, a tale of two cities. Babylon, the city of man, which derives from Babel. And Jerusalem, the city of God, corrupt though it is through man's leadership, will ultimately be replaced by the new Jerusalem. But these two themes start here in Genesis 11 and are followed through all the way to Revelation chapter 21. Now, there are three major promises we're going to discover in the scripture. The first is God's covenant with Abraham that we'll take up in the next session. That in his seed, all nations, not just Jews, all nations will be blessed. We're going to talk a lot. Very important to understand the covenant with Abraham. Another covenant is with the nation Israel, but this is one that has conditions upon it. If they faithfully served them, they'd prosper, and if they forsook him, they would be destroyed or subjugated or put into bondage. We also find that God made a covenant with David, that his family would produce the Messiah who would reign over God's people forever. The first and third of these three were unconditional. We're going to emphasize that as we go and why we believe that. Absolutely essential you understand that. Yes, the covenant with the nation Israel had some conditions and fine print. But these other two are crucial to you and I, crucial to all of us. And so, again, through this path of history, we're going to be shifting then to the call of Abraham. We're going to, at the next session, go from Abraham, his call, through the patriarchs, right up into the Exodus. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph will constitute chapters 12 through 50 in the book of Genesis for hour number 4 of our Learn the Bible in 24-hour survey.